try to review some of the basics now for those who aren't here. So I bought in my book, called the Haggadah Canon book. See? Makes the Tefillah scale look small. You remember how thick that was, by the same author, but twice the size. So we'll try to give an overview. Haggadah Kelim means that if a person, if a particular tree was used for non-kosher food, this is why it makes the Tefillah scale look small. You remember how thick that was, by the same author, but twice the size. So we'll try to give an overview. Haggadah Kelim means that if a person, if a particular tree was used for non-kosher food, is required to purge the non-kosher absorption from the kli in a way which is kabbalo kapoko. I mean, the same way they came in, that's the way it comes out. Simple shot dictates that this is not anything occult, anything ritual in the sense of non-scientific. Rather, it's simply a way in which, according to the Chazal, the absorption could be removed. And as a matter of fact, there are those who maintain for this reason that nowadays that our kelim are different than the kelim of old, that perhaps the lachas of Haggadah, of kashering, should be completely revamped. The problem is we're not experts in determining the precise realia. Does, for example, a metal pot made today in the modern factories, is there any absorption? The rabbis assume, based on the psukim and other sources, that the metal of their time had absorption. A metal pot would absorb taste from non-kosher foods and could emit some of the taste into a kosher food, rendering it non-kosher. That's all based for Haggadah. Some say today that the metal is different. Why is it different? Well, in those days, they didn't have factories and laboratories. They just made things, you know. How should I say? Every pot was different. There was no assembly lines. Every pot was, you took some tools, you bang a little bit here, bang a little bit there, put it in the fire, came in, came out. It was what we might call an inexact science. And therefore, it was certainly possible that there were pores in the metal, pore being holes, into which the non-kosher absorption could enter and it would come out. Those same holes when you cook kosher food. Today, however, the pots are made in precision fashion. For those who maintain that the possibility of this kind of absorption does not exist. This has been, you know, the posts don't like to talk about it too loud, only in hushed tones, because they're afraid that someone will just eliminate the whole part of Haggadah. They don't want to go that far. But I can point to at least one source where this is written in a sort of a kind of a backhanded way. The OU, Orthodox Union, the biggest kashrus organization in the world, I think. I'm not sure about the Rabbanut, but certainly the biggest one outside of Eretz Yisrael. Published a periodical called Mesorah, and there was a whole issue concerning tuna fish. Used, apparently, the same baskets that were used to contain the tuna fish cans, which were put in what they call a retort, a major facility to steam and to cook the tuna fish, on the same basket they used to put cat food in a cat food can. And they would steam the cat food and make that into something which is cooked. And the question became, wait, should we worry about the absorption of taste from the cat food into the basket, from the basket into the tuna fish? So, Rav Shechter Shalita, who's a Rebbe in our yeshiva, also a Kashrus authority for the OU, wrote a whole complicated answer. At the end, he threw in, it was like, you know, an afterthought, that, well, he was told by experts that this particular material, plastic, metal, whatever it happens to be, there's no absorption. Nothing goes in. And although we don't have to rely on this exclusively, but in conjunction with other factors, so we can throw this into the hopper too. Another reason why we can allow this process to continue. That's where I saw it in print. But in the classical form, they're sort of afraid to mention this. You know, it doesn't look as if the halacha changed. The halacha doesn't change, the facts change. But anyway, just be aware of this. The principle of Kibolo Kapolto tells us that as it goes in, it goes out. If it's cold, just rinse it off. If it's hot, if it's on the fire, it requires libud, which means fire. If it's in a water medium, liquid medium, it's not that hagolah, which means it's filled with boiling water. And if it's what we call irui, you pour trade food upon it from a pot which is on the fire. So the way to get kasher is to get with irui, by pouring boiling hot water over it. Sure. Kibolo kapolto is the cardinal rule of kasher. The way it came in, it's the way it goes out. If it went in cold, it comes out cold. If it went in on the fire, it comes out of the fire. If it goes in with klirishon, it goes out of klirishon. If it goes in with irui, it goes out with irui. Cliche is a question for halal, whether you require kasher. We discussed this at some length back at Simon Klopay, and here the same question exists. If cliche would require kashering, you could kasher it in a cliche. If. Now, the general principle is when kasher with hagolah, not to kasher any kli, which is what we call a ben yomo. Phrase we've had time and time and time again. You wait 24 hours until you before you undergo the kashering procedure. The reason is quite elementary. If you kasher something within 24 hours, the following fear exists. The non-kosher taste, which was absorbed in the pot, will go into the water and go right back from the water into the pot. So it will be a disaster. The kasher will be completely futile. It will accomplish nothing. You may ask, so what is to be gained by waiting 24 hours? So the answer is, if you wait 24 hours, even if the taste is reabsorbed from the water into the pot, but we have a rule, eino ben yomo, it's mutter. This is more than 24 hours, so it's mutter. So you may ask, so why bother kashering? The kashering is a joke. If you do it within 24 hours, you cannot kasher. Once wait more than 24 hours, then even if you use this pot without kashering, and you cook kosher food, kosher food is still going to be kosher. That's the whole principle. Eino ben yomo does not make anything great. So what do you accomplish by kashering? So the answer is as follows. If you don't kasher, then the taste which is going to go from the pot into the kosher food which you cook subsequently is what's called tchilas liyoso l'shvach. It started off good. As soon as the non-kosher food, the lard, the ham, the bacon, was cooked in this pot, at that point that had a very pleasant taste. 24 hours elapsed, becomes an unpleasant taste. But it started off good. It starts off good, the Chazal said, well, don't use it. You made a gzera, einu ben yomo, otu ben yomo. Don't use it now, because you make, even after 24 hours elapsed, because next thing you know, you lose it before the 24 hours elapsed. That's where it started off good. But if you kasher after 24 hours, so the original taste is history. That's removed completely from the pot. What are you worried about? That new taste, which was drawn out from the pot, will go into the water, will go back from the water right into the pot all over again. Yeah, but that's tchilas liyoso lifka. That's its very inception, from the very beginning, that started off negative. that 24-hour-old plus taste. So it starts off negative. If it starts off negative, the rabbis are not so concerned to confuse it with a case in which the 24 hours did not elapse. That's what kashrut achieves. All it does is it changes the bliya from tchilasol, the shvach to tchilasol of gam. Yes?
And so the inu binyomo, we in inu binyomo, does that apply even if it's a machacharif, or does it make a difference if it isn't?
Well, machacharif obviates to some extent the inu binyomo leniency. So of course the question will come to how do you catch something, aren't you worried about a machacharif? It's a very good question. Very good question. So the answer is, presumably, that once you do the kashering process, you remove everything from the pot, even though it comes back again, and so the kashering comes back again a second time, is chilas also the tgam, and now what's going to happen if that interacts with a machal karet? That's a very good question. I haven't answered it yet. I'm going to look it up in the book. I have the Bible here. Man has here 500 pages. It should answer your question. Let's see. Very sharp radish, which is hardly ever used, and that you wouldn't use in a kashrut pot. But of course, the question becomes: most poskim assume that davar charif applies even beyond chiltus to all sharp things, onions, for example. So the question becomes: if you kashrut a pot, how can you use it for onions? I'm not sure the answer. Wow. I think one time they had answers, but I don't know what it is. The Raj gets the question, which is an interesting answer, which we probably don't accept on law. I don't know what the right answer is. Yes?
I'm not sure what the question is, that the town that flows from the trade department, that's got the question of the and go into the water and go into the pot.
Back to the pot of Lord again. That's great. So that's no problem. Tchilas liyoso lifgam. No problem. So now if you want to cook noodles in that pot right away, so what got into it? No pot of God, no problem. The question is, would you cook onions in that pot? The onions have a power to take a stale taste and reinvigorate it. The question would be, so what could that kashrut do? That's a very good question. I don't know the answer. Chassam Sof and the Rashbam are bothered by this kashrut. Make a note. Now I'm going to put a bookmark here to remind me to look up.
Oh, no, the bookmark here already. Extra bookmark for the remind me to look up.
Okay, I don't know. Okay. Those are the rules of Hagolah, the basis of Hagolah. Now, some utensils cannot have Hagolah at all. The laws of Hagolah are really on Hilchos Pesach. That's why I didn't have it with me. The Mishnah Berurah Chelek, okay? Simen Tov Nun Aleph. Start off by saying that it's earthenware, there cannot be any kasher. Cannot kasher earthenware. Why? Because it absorbs tremendously and it doesn't all come out. You can't get it out with the kasher process. You get it out with what we call a Leibun process, which is putting it to fire. The answer is yes, in theory, but the Chazal are afraid that a person may be wary not to break the earthenware dish, and he won't do a good job. They said you can't catch your earthenware on a normal lead wood, let's say taking a fire to it, or blowtorch, or things of this nature. Because you're afraid you won't do a good job, it's going to ruin it. Shulchan Aruch does say that if you put it back into the kiln, the full hafzor and the kivshonos, as the Gemara puts it, put back into the kiln, then, obviously you're not afraid it's going to break. You're putting it into the kiln. If it breaks, it won't break. But you're not going to, there's no pussy putting about it. It's in the kiln is closed. So then, the Shulchan Aruch said, you can kash. It's possible, maybe, that this is what is the closest we have to a kiln today is a self-cleaning oven. You're not going to go to the factory again, all the way in. But a self-cleaning oven, how hot does it get? What's it going to say? No, nobody? 900 degrees, something like that? That's the one? It'll get very, very hot. So if you put the earthenware dish in the self-cleaning oven, look, it'll smash, it'll come out, so we can't lose. Somebody's going to throw it out. They need to throw it out anyway. I just had a question recently about a corny ware dish. I told them to throw it out. They have to tell them to try the self-cleaning oven. I'm assuming that in ourself, again, I'll talk about the fact, what's special about a kibshon is that it gets very, very hot right away. So it's impossible to worry that you're going to put it and take it right out again, because the phrase is going to break. The minute he puts it in, it's going to get very, very hot. I understand, maybe I'm wrong, that a self can go up and gets hot right away. Maybe somebody do some research. How long does it take to get to this 900 degrees? Nobody knows. If it doesn't get there right away, then it could be a problem. Anyway, you just roll these things out. Okay. Some of it is made from metal. be kashrut either with hagala, if it's used with water, or with libun, with fire, if it was used with fire. How hot does the fire be? We discussed this a little bit last time. The big dispute. Some say it has to be hot enough that sparks will fly. According to Rav Moshe, it's reported about at 700 degrees, as quoted in this Hagala's Kehillah book. Others say it's more or less, different estimates. And there are some poskim who seem to claim that it's enough that it gets as hot as it ever was to absorb the food, what they call kabolo kapoto. The same heat that it came in, it goes out. So the hottest it could get in an oven, because we have thermostats these days, is let's say 400 or 500 degrees. As long as you put it up to 500 degrees, we say kabolo kapoto. The Mishnah Brewer seems to have a compromise. Namely, that if the surface of which you're kashering is going to touch the food, then we have to go be very, very strict. If the surface is going to touch the food, we have to actually heat it up to the extent that it really turns red. Which nowadays is just about impossible. Unless with a blowtorch, which is dangerous, so basically forget about it. But if it does not touch the food, it's just an oven, and you're going to ultimately use that oven by putting food in pots in the oven, not directly on the floor of the oven. Then we rely on the fact that it reaches so hot as it ever reached when the non-kosher was cooking. So therefore, according to this compromise of the Mishnah Brewer, it would seem that our ovens can be kosher by putting up to the maximum temperature. We don't put food on the floor of the oven. We put the pots and the pans, which are in the oven. So that's why I tell people, as Rav Soloveitchik told me, I heard it from his mouth, that a person is permitted to kosher an oven by putting it up to the highest maximum temperature. How long must you leave it there? I don't know, as long as it takes to reach the highest point that ever reaches in use. I don't know how long you have to ask an expert. Some say half an hour. I think estimates range from a half an hour to an hour. By that time, it's reached, it's not going to get any hotter with the thermostat effect. Or most of the Kohen Levi disagree. No. Has to be red hot no matter what, even if you're not putting food on it. He claimed you can't kosher an oven. All you can use is what he called an insert. Unless you use a blowtorch, what we said last week? 8 minutes at every square inch. I forgot what it's some kind of wild figure which is almost unattainable. It'll probably ruin the oven completely if you do that. As a result of this, it seems to me that whatever touches food directly, it's very hard to kosher in real life. You have to, according to the compromised opinion, it have to get so hot that sparks are going to fly. And to do that without endangering yourself or ruining the utensil is almost impossible. By contrast, if it does not touch the food directly, much more room to be lenient. That's enough to get as hot as it ever got. Put yourself to the government should work for these kinds of things. Mentioned last week also that in order for Hagala to work with water, it has to be smooth. No rust. No cracks. If you have rust or cracks, you have to use libun. Put a fire to it, which will presumably eliminate the rust and the cracks. You put it to self-clean, I think it does eliminate the rust and get into the cracks, but I'm not sure as far as the cracks. You see, in the old days, when they talked about libun, it meant you literally applied a fire to it. Our ovens, there's heat, but there's no fire. The fire is behind the wall somewhere. I'm not sure if he's going to really get into that crack. But I think the assumptions were usually lenient in these matters. The dispute exists, can we rely on the majority use of a particular utensil? If the majority of use was what we call Erud, pouring, the Shulchan Aruch says, you can kosher with Iru, even though it's possible that occasionally it was used literally on the fire. We followed the majority. The Ramah calls it a dissenting position. He's probably in the minority of the most strict use. And the Mishnah Berurah says, well, if it's not, if it's an Ein or Ben Yomo, it hasn't been used in 24 hours, then so she's stuck. There's room to be lenient. I had this question just, I think, yesterday. The burner of an oven upon which the pots rest. So, strictly speaking, they don't kasha it at all. Because, as we mentioned already a long time ago, Ein b'lua yotzi mikli l'kli b'lo roter. Sometimes it's absorbed in it, even if it's absorbed, cannot get out without a medium of a liquid. A liquid means significant liquid. Nonetheless, this is a custom to kasha it. And you put it in a self-clean, should be good enough. Pans are a big problem. Should pans be considered like pots? Or should pans be considered like grills? What's the pros and the cons? On the one hand, it's like a grill because no liquid medium. On the other hand, it's like a pot because the bottom of it separates between the fire and the food. In a grill, that wouldn't be the case. Again, a dispute. The Shabbat is considered like a pot, the Ramos is considered like a grill. We try to be strict. Shabbat and Yerodea, we learned last week, says Machvas, we have to split between Pesach and other Yisurim. What does that mean? You would always say that Pesach is more strict, right? You know, we've had it so many times. No, you're wrong. Pesach is more lenient than the Shabbat. What? Why should Pesach be more lenient than other prohibitions? It's more strict. The answer is, on Pesach you can kasher before the fact. You kasher before Pesach enters. It's called hetera bola, that you're eliminating the food before it becomes officially non-kosher. By Chazir and the Vela, you can't do that. It's already non-kosher. But the Shulchan Aruch draws the distinction between one and the other. We mentioned the handles have to be kashered, put it in boiling water, those on the outside. The covers have to be kashered. Tables, you pour boiling water over them. If it was used incorrectly for cold, it has no consequence. Just rinse it off. Here's a question. You have glazed china. Now, we mentioned last week that many people say that glass is not bolea. Does not absorb anything. What about glazed china? The Shulchan Aruch says, well, you have to treat it like china. Why? Because isn't the glass a barrier? So, well, we're afraid they're going to be holes or through. There are some radical rabbis today suggest, as Palom Lodi mentioned earlier, that our glazed china is different. That if it looks smooth and you see no cracks in the glazed finish, then it's room to be lenient on the ground that nothing goes through. Because our is done under laboratory conditions, factory conditions. Many don't agree with that. You won't find it in print, I don't believe. But there are very prominent rabbis who have said that. Yes?
I could really be misunderstanding what you said before, but is this like contradicting what Shulchan Aruch says about tefillah with
no, like? Tefillah is one thing and kashering is something else. We mentioned last week, or the week before, whatever it was, that although the Shulchan Aruch said that glazed china has to be terrible, but our glaze does not have to be terrible. Why not? Too thin. It's insignificant. That's true when you measure the identity. What is this clear? We talk about significance. But here we're measuring science, not existential identity. science. If it's a glass finish, nothing goes through. That's what some posts could have said. Everyone agrees. We already mentioned before, when it comes to glass itself, so the Ramah is called the leniency. Some say we're strict only on Pesach of glass, and if it's not Pesach, we're lenient, even if it's for hot use. And Pesach is more strict because of the mushroom problem, even a tiny little bit of the problem. And others say no, Ramah is only lenient when it comes to cold absorption. Kabush, when it's used for to put your non kosher soup in it, or things of this nature, which is cold. But the minute it gets hot, then there's no room for leniency, because of the second opinion. It's a big dispute, whether you use the same glassware for milk suppressions. It's a big dispute. We already mentioned a very critical point. The kasher, many things at the same pot, you throw a little bit in, and the boiling stops. So the room temperature, or the cold metal temperature brings down the water temperature, and the boil just stops bubbling, stops boiling. So you really shouldn't use it at that point. When it stops bubbling, boiling, it's not proper to use that water for hagolah, says the Shulchan Aruch. Now we also mentioned that according to many poskim, I believe Rav Moshe included, that's only true if we don't have any idea how hot the water got when you were cooking non-kosher. The hottest it can get, we assume, is 212. So if we have boiling, so that's an equivalence, there's no problem. But let's say we know for a fact that never went above 150, 170, 180, 190. How do we know? We have temperature charts, it's in a food, it's in a plant, it's a factory. It's been 190 in, 190 out, kibolo kapolto. Imagine if you can't fit the pot into another pot in one shot, you can do it piecemeal, half at a time. If it's the absolutely biggest, most humongous pot, which can't go into anything, then the whole discussion what you do. You take a little rim, put it on the outside, some of the cuts of taking a hot piece of metal and throwing it into the water, the water will overflow and it'll be very, very hot. Different ways of handling this. This is some highlights of the Mishnah Berurah and Shulchan Aruch, and Arachayim Tafnun Aleph and Tafnun Beis. You remember a few weeks ago we learned the book Tevilas Kalim by the same author as Hagolas Hakam. He had a list of all different kinds of materials, all kinds of different kelim. Well, he has here also called the order of Aleph Beis. He has, you're not going to believe it, 166 pages, excuse me, 166 pages of a list of kelim. Take a little time to read off the 166 pages. Maybe you have a few questions about examples, and then I'll be able to save some time. Any question that you have about a particular kli, how to kasher it, or if you can kasher it. Last week we read off the list from Rabbi Feldman, right?
Yeah.
Karel Corning Way was, I believe, strict about it. Glass could be lenient except for Pesach. So I don't want to count the microwaves for Pesach. So we made some glass. So that's what this man has to offer in his 166 pages. This is going to give you a very brief, I mean, you can't go through everything. stoneware can be kashrut. It's the full stone. It's ground up and it's considered an earthenware, which cannot. Aluminum can be kashrut like other metals. But enamel, most poskim say that enamel is like earthenware, cannot be kashrut.
The first thing?
For the most poskim, it's like enamel.
Like what?
Enamel cannot be kashrut. Let's talk about spookus. He discussed at length something which would be called Yiddish shtelling, milui v'irui. If the glass was used for coal, they would fill it up with water for 3 days. Fill it up and empty it. Fill it up and empty it. Fill it up and empty it. Presto, it's okay. Yes.
How do you kosher a potato
or,
you know, like after races?
I know the potatoes. Very well. It's a good question. What do you want to retain it? How do you just put it in cold water and rinse it out? I don't think you have to worry about kosher. I don't know. What happens if you put it in that water? What happens to it? Like you're ruined, right? I'll try it. Okay. Someone answered the question. You got the first part. I was seeing the answer of a question. He answered this 2 weeks ago. What about retainers? He wanted somebody to make a bracha on the retainer. They have a whole new book on retainers. Now, there's a specialization. Hilchos retainers. If you make a bracha on the retainer, the mouth is not. The mouth. Out. Thank you. You have to cash your retainer. All kinds of things. See, it's a back in a whole book about retainers. How to come out of here. So. Yeah, what's the question?
I've been a glass. I used to use a glass baking dish.
Yeah.
And like if you're in a police department and you double wrap it, it's like it's a...
The glass baking dish like absorbs, you know, heat from the milk and then put it in the leishik oven.
So.
The leishik oven, you cook something.
Like you want to, you know, like lasagna or something, and you double wrap it.
And the milk is the power.
With cheese.
Cheese. And the baking dish is pop, it's milk mix, and the food is milk mix, and the oven is flavored. Double wrap. Okay. You know, don't panic. Sometimes people say, I use a tray for pot, a tray for dish, kaval, a tray for this, a tray for that. Mehikar didn't strictly speak, we hold that if something is a cliche, it doesn't render food tray. Before you start throwing out dishes and throwing out food, always a special by rope. Don't ever throw anything out before you ask a special. You never know what the rubble pull out of sleep. Maybe it's an anibinyomo, maybe it's a cliche, maybe it's, you never know. Yes.
It's simply about microwave that might not even be considered a piece of sweet stone.
Maybe not.
Something that got treated in microwave, not the law, but saying that it's good stuff.
Could be a five and trade. Believe it or not. Possible. Yeah.
When you're cooking milk in the double wrap, you have to wrap all the way around
the cover. Well, it's covered, it's good enough
for me. And it's the need to wrap two covers?
Just to make sure that steam won't come out. If it's solid, we learned before, it could be under the end cover. Solid, no steam. Yeah?
You said that you can put
Yeah.
The glass is cold?
Correct. That's a complicated story. It's a kind of a kavush, and it's the way it comes in, it's the way it goes out. Believe me, it's very complicated. And people don't do it anymore these days. We live in a rich country. Either you buy glass, you buy new glass, which pays them, or you use paper cups. What's so terrible? Paper cups saves the dishwasher goes on and pays them. Oh, paper cups, that's simple yantim. And some people say, how can I use paper on yantim? It's a yantim thing. Those are the only men who don't wash dishes.
So is that a hint?
You can quote me.
We have it on tape.
Okay. Dishwasher. Kasher, a dishwasher. Well, it's made from plastic. Some folks can say yes.
What's
the dishwasher? The whole dishwasher, the walls. Many dishwashers are made from plastic. So, plastic, we said, you can kasher, except for Pesach. Made from metal, you can kasher it. Made from the old ones, made from porcelain of the old dishwashers, then you cannot cash it. From Moshe has a tshuva, but she writes, if you wait a year after the last use for trade, then it becomes kosher by, you know, then you can cash it. Where'd the year come from? Well, in one context of the Yaineser, it says if you wait a year, it's all right. But Moshe relies on that for dishwashers.
Racks,
he says, better to get new ones. You can't clean it properly. If you can clean it properly, then it'll be alright. Yes?
If it's plastic, is it okay to wait a year?
No. Plastic, you can cash it right away. Not wait a year, wait a day. Cash it. The Pesach. No, not the Pesach.
Why not?
Why not what?
It's
made from plastic, so we assume with respect to Pesach, the plastic, you can't cash it. We mentioned already last time. There's going to be a little bit left. I'm not sure. But it's made from metal, that's no problem. Kasher even for Pesach. Made from porcelain, you can't kasher it at all.
If it's made from metal, do you need to wait a year?
No. Made from porcelain, you wait a year.
Porcelain,
you wait a year? Right, it's cooler. I have some gutter to buy a new dishwasher for hundreds of dollars. You wait a whole year, you figure by that time everything's dried out. Alright. Try to get through. Wood! You can catch the wood. Bones. Say you can, some are afraid you won't do a good job.
Bones?
It's bone, B-O-N-E-S. Play answer. Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have a person in the sink, so you have, let's say, you put a bucket or something to wash your dishes.
Right.
If your dish touches the sink, well, is that rendered grape?
No, we discussed the great length a month or two ago, I forgot, a long time ago, that the chance of rendering something tray from your sink, your kitchen sink, is almost nil. With many considerations, Iwui, Nipsak, and Nizkal, and then it's not Klippa, oh, he went through the whole business.
So I can't use the sink then?
So Moshe says it's better not to, because you never make a mistake. And he's, well, who knows what? But this, it's hard to really make a tray. This is according to the Ramah, if you remember, the Shach disagrees, but this is really old stuff. Yes?
We worry.
You mean the hood?
Right.
We discussed the hood, did we not? Did we
yes.
I think so.
We said that in
the so hood, we said we can be lenient on the ground that the steam dissipates. Right, for what's wide open. Wide open. Okay. Up to the resh. Shin. Yatif. That's the kasha yatif. For Pesach, I'm not kidding. You should brush it. Not the kasha. False teeth is a big problem. What do you have false teeth? You have a filling. So your filling is metal, it absorbs chametz, and now it's Pesach. What do you do about the filling? It's a big problem. So the minig is to be lenient. He calls it a real chumrah, it's a b'nei brak chumrah. Don't eat hot chametz 24 hours before the Erev Pesach. Because it's going to have a bad impact. Wild. And then it looks like false teeth, so they should soak them in hot water. The lengthy discussion of ovens, which we spoke about before, I'll repeat it. Feldes book, whatever it was called. Now we've been over this whole thing two times. Questions? I'll take questions now before we proceed to the next topic. Everything's clear? Wonderful. All right. One more point. Kuf Kav Beis talks about Noset Tam of Gam. It says the average kli in the house of a goy is considered to be Becheskas Eino Ben Yomo. Most utensils are not used within the last 24 hours. You have a right to rely on that. you buy a candle from a guardian, and he says they're new, and you trust them. It was used for pork, to rinse down well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big problem. It all depends upon the case. I think if you're buying it from Farberware, which is a reputable firm, that you cannot assume they use it for pork. We did mention, I think, last time that some of these utensils they always use apparently for non-kosher. Some of the Teflon itself is not kosher. buy a cannon from a guy, and he says they're new, you trust them. And we're going to use for pork. Rinse that well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big problem. It all depends upon the case. I think if you buy them from Farberware, a reputable firm, that you cannot assume they use it for pork. We did mention, I think, last time, that some of these utensils they always use apparently for non-kosher. Some of the Teflon itself is not kosher. The coating. And some say that the toast we mentioned last time, the toast is used for the experiment with Wonder Bread or some other non-kosher bread. It was not kosher. So we had a kiddush from Rav Moshe, I think I told you this last time. Rav Moshe, the only reason why you cannot use a kli, which is not used in more than 24 hours, is Zera Eino Ben Yomo Otto Ben Yomo. You're confusing your mind. This is used 20 hours ago, 30 hours ago, who can remember? If you were using the kind of a kli that can never be used within 24 hours at the time that the potential non-kosher food hit it. Why? Because it's a pot is made, they apply Teflon, and this is non-kosher, in the factory. You can't get from the factory to your kitchen in 24 hours or less. It's an impossibility. You shift here, and to the store, to the store. Impossible. The same with the toast. Even if they would use non-kosher bread in the experiment, no way a toast can get from the factory to you in 24 hours or less. Impossible.
It's okay.
It's okay, and that makes sense. Wow. You mentioned last time, didn't we not? I think so.
So
Teflon has yes. If they become trade, it's a problem. But the fact that they have that coating, that itself would not be a problem. Okay? Everything's clear, I hope. Hope so. We now embark upon the next topic. The next topic is called Yayin Nesa. Yayin Nesa is the bridge between two areas of halacha found in the Yoredei. The first is kashrus, which we've been discussing until now, and the next is avodah zarah, which we'll discuss later. Yayin Nesef has two problems. One is a general issue of intermarriage. We've been through this before. Remember the Pasakum and Bishalakum, who were fear of camaraderie, fraternity, fellowship, which might lead to intermarriage. And they said, no. Intu, wives belong to non-Jews. It's a very powerful agent of intermarriage and the like. And therefore they say, don't touch it. However, there's an additional dimension concerning Yayin Nesef in particular, which is the possibility that a guy took the wine and poured it in front of his idol as a form of idol worship. What's the difference between these two reasons? If both reasons are there, what's the difference between the two reasons? According to the very first reason, into marriage, so the yayin should be only also b'shtia, not b'halo. Same as pasakum and bishalakum, it's also only to eat. So too should be also only to drink. There should be no prohibition against halo. However, according to the second reason, that is the fear that the goy may have actually made this. What does it mean yayin nesa? The person took the wine and he took it, let's say, with his hands, and he poured it in front of an idol. Took the glass, poured the wine in front of some idol. That's really Yayin Nesef. So afraid that people confuse what they call Stam Yenam, a very important phrase. Stam, what does Stam mean? Plain. Stam Yenam, plain their wine, the wine of Goyim. People might confuse this with the wine that they use for their sacrament. So they said, we have to usher all Goyish wine. If this is the case, it's also even bahana. Also even to have any pleasure, because you know, avodah zarah, it's also bahana. Not also ba'achila, b'shtia, eating and drinking, it's also to have any hana from it. So therefore the Shulchan Aruch writes that stam yeinam is also bahana. Period. Can't have any hana from it. Not only that, but even if it does not belong to the guy, it's Jewish wine, but the Jewish wine was touched by a non-Jew, bingo, it's also asa bahana. That's why, if you have to be very careful, the non-Jews in the house, they shouldn't touch our wine. We'll discuss the details as we go.
Is that why you're not Shomer Shabbos Jew?
That's another good question. A non-Shomer Shabbos Jew, so what do you say about it? On the one hand, he doesn't bow down to idols, right? On the other hand, you're allowed to marry his daughter. So at first glance, if you follow the two reasons that are given for the Easter of Stam Yeinam, it should not apply to a non-observant, a non-Shomer Shabbos Jew. Right? I mean, either reason seems to be very pertinent concerning such an individual. So some, in fact, are you right? The most authorities disagree. They say, look, the Gemara has an expression that the Mechal Shabbos is considered like, well, almost like a goy. It denies the mitzvah which confirms that God created the world. He doesn't believe in the basis of faith. And therefore, we have to treat his wine as if a goy had touched it. There is a major issue in the post-game. What about modern? Modern Mechal Shabbos. Was it modern and old time? The old time Mechal Shabbos were rebellious. They were brought up to keep Shabbos. They rebelled against it. And today, the overwhelming majority of people who don't keep Shabbos, the younger ones, the majority is even higher, they were never taught about Shabbos. They were never taught properly when they were young. Unfortunately, majority of the Jews, I'm sorry to say it, in the world today are not Shomer Shabbos. So, this is true quite a number of years back. So there were those who are growing up now, they weren't taught. It's called Tinok Shenishbo. As if a child is taken captive amongst the non-Jews. Here he's taken captive among Jews. His parents, who are not Shomer Shabbos, and they teach him the wrong religion. This is a big, big question. What are you doing with these people? Is there wine a problem or is it not a problem? So I tell them, in my house, we try very hard to use only what's called yayin mevushal. Yayin mevushal means the wine is cooked. And it says in Shulchan Aruch that the wine is cooked and a guy touches it, no problem. What's so special about cooked wine? Well, the answer is cooked wine is considered inferior. I'm not an expert, but it's considered inferior by the wine industry, by people. And as such, they would never use cooked wine to pour on them as bad. Never. They wouldn't use cooked wine to, the disgrace, use inferior stuff and pour it on the altar for their gods. So therefore, there's no prohibition of Stam Yeinam. The Rosh Hashanah is a very famous kashan. That takes care of the problem of nisuch, of pouring on the altar. What happened to the problem of intermarriage? How's it going to stop intermarriage if the wine was cooked? Right? If using the goy's wine is one of the reasons why it's not allowed, so it leads to intermarriage, so how does it help that you cooked it? That shouldn't be of any consequence. Not so fancy. Okay, some say. It's not fancy enough. You know, it's not a go restaurant. Bread is not fancy, but bread is a staple. So that's why, you know, everything has its own little thing. Or some say, the Russians say, that yayin mevushal in days gone by was a very infrequent occurrence. People didn't cook wine. Cooking wine renders it inferior. There is a man on my block who was in the wine industry. He once was so irate about this cooked wine. He told me like this, I remember years ago. So when you cook the wine, catch this now. It takes the guts out of the wine.
and the wine of dust to begin with, but that's what he said. Texta, yeah. So it's an infrequent thing, at least it was in those days. You know, nowadays it's very common to have cooked wine, the wine is cooked. Then we don't make luxarius. Luxarius didn't apply in those days, it was infrequent. So even though today it's more frequent, we don't reenact new restrictions. And therefore, bottom line, that cooked wine is considered exempted from the prohibition of stamina. You have in your house only cooked wine, so you're home free. I don't care who touches the wine. Jew, non-observant Jew, it doesn't make a difference. If it's cooked wine, nothing can happen. You know, if you buy certain companies, it has on the bottle itself, it says Yayin Levusho. That means cooked wine. How cooked is cooked? It doesn't say explicitly. But the matter of dispute, according to many of the classical Poskim, it had to be really, really hot. So hot that some of it will actually boil off. A wine will maybe boil off at a lower temperature than the water, but it has to get pretty hot. Rav Moshe says, no. As long as it's hot enough, it's called Yatzalet as well. That's good enough. How hot is that? So you write different things. Something 160, 175, that's pretty hot. Let's say 160. And some say even less than that. When it says Yayin Mevushel, and for example on the Kedem, to give an example, I don't want to give any commercials, but Kedem is probably the most popular wine in America. Alright? I think it's going to be able to use the Kiddush. No? Am I right? Yeah? Kedem wine, if it says Yayin Mevushel in the Kedem wine, it means, I think it's even printed, before paper they put it in, they run a whole ad about this. Ever see this? They got big ads in the Jewish newspapers. If it says Mevushel on the Kedem wine, it means Mevushel to 200 something degrees, which is the requirement of the Salem Arov, the Mashkiach. That's why you'll note that the Kedem grape juice is not Mevushel. Although it is cooked, it's not cooked to a high enough degree temperature to satisfy the Salem Arov. So we have grape juice in our house. We don't worry about going. We consider it to be revolutionary, because grape juice by definition has to be cooked. But it's not that hot, so therefore, for a you consider it to be revolutionary. But they don't put revolutionary on the bottle because it's telling the rebel letter. Yeah?
I don't understand why grape juice should have the
guys from 99. What do you think
grape juice is? But it's not going to be used in animals, right? It's not used in animals.
What do you think grape juice is?
Well,
it's wine, that's cooked. Yeah, I understand. The height upon wine. Wine is defined as soon as you crush the grapes and a liquid flows away from those grapes, it's called hamshacha, that's called wine. Before you had a chance to make it into grapes, it already was wine. And if a guy touched it at that point, it's over. It's not going to help to sell the grape juice.
I just don't understand why, because it just wouldn't be used in those grapes.
Doesn't make a difference. Once it became usser as the INS, you can't cleanse it, you can't make it cooked. But practically, at least as far as cannabis, I believe, is concerned, the very, very big bottles are not mevushel at all. But some rabbis adopt the dom mevushel. I don't get involved in this kiddush now. But some say in the kiddush you should have yayin which is not mevushel. So they have a big air, the big, big ones are not mevushel. The smaller ones, the ones like about, that's it. A little bit bigger than that. You know, that's a little taller than that. One that people use very often use, that I think is 20 something ounces. Those are put on the top. Yayin Mevushel. That we have in my house. You know, one of the small, a little more expensive. That's more convenient though at the store. Big bottle, and it breaks less breaks, you know, and it's spills less spills. Plus a few more pennies, so it's worthwhile. There's no problem of going for touching the wine. That's what I recommend very strongly. Your house should not have any unbelievable wine. It's not a good idea. Yeah.
Look at the fact that a non-observant Jew was raised in a Jewish home, so we don't call
him a Jewish home
anymore.
He's a Jewish home. observant of another.
He's a Jewish homie. He knows about...
What do you mean knows? Well, when he went to yeshiva?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I don't know. I'm just asking.
Went to yeshiva? So what went wrong? Maybe it's a bad yeshiva. He didn't just went to yeshiva. I won't mention his name. Can't give a sweeping statement. Well, they didn't go to yeshiva, you can't give a sweeping statement. They didn't go to yeshiva. So, what do you expect these guys? So the public school is directly from? Yeah. Some classical Yayin Nesek of the Gemara is never both. But the Pasuk today, I haven't gotten to it yet, say that today there's not much worry about Avodah Zarah. Why not? Christians are considered over there Avodah Zarah. Nah, you think they really believe in they don't believe in anything. They just go and buy Santa Claus. They don't believe in anything, most Christians. It's an amazing expression. As an expression of the Gemara, that all think of Chavim B'chutzlars, going out of the main centers, it's just what we call, and they borrow a phrase from the Gemara in different kind of, Minig Avoseim B'yadeim. That's it. They may go to Mass here and there, they may sing jingle bells, I don't know what they're going to do now. Again, when you walk the streets now, they'll get involved with the culture. December. It's starting 2 days, so you have to watch out. They don't really mean it, but they don't really, it's amazing, but they don't really mean it, then there are many leniencies which we can apply. We're going to try to get to it later today, if we have time. Yeah?
Can you explain more
about
the difference between the big battle, the little battle,
and the little battle? That's just the way they do it. The big battle, they don't cook. They never reach a high temperature. And the small battle, they cook to 190 or 210 degrees.
It's
from the same big thing. They take half of it, they cook it, they put it in the small bottle. Yeah. They take half of it, they don't cook it, they put it in the big bottle. That's it. Kedem one is all by from you. They say, you take the word for it. Yes?
Are you just thinking about
Kedem
grape juice or any grape juice?
I think all grape juice is mavushal. Not 200 degrees, but it's mavushal to the point of, let's call the yachts lettuce or two yachts touch. Otherwise, it can't become grape juice. That's what I understand.
So we're okay with it.
All grape juice you're okay with, basically. Unless you're Taylor Mechostin and you want to...
So the big
time
is okay.
Grape juice will never say the lishal, not big or small. The distinction I just drew is as far as wine is concerned.
Yeah,
the
big juice,
the big and little. Big and little, either says lishal. No difference.
They go and are.
What?
They don't say that they are?
No, grape juice is no difference between big and small. It's all the same thing.
Ah, I do that.
Why is the difference? I'm sorry for that clear. But we can be, Armenia has to drink all grape juice because it will all reach a certain level of levushal. By the way, who knows the fact, the science? Is all wine pasteurized? Milk is always pasteurized. No wine. Grape juice. Must they be pasteurized? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question. What if it is pasteurized? Does that make it automatically mavushal?
Yes.
That's what I thought. The answer would be yes. And many rabbis seem to say that way too. But the late Goyim Tzadik of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, no. He thinks that pasteurization does not render it to be considered mavushal. That's nothing. It tastes the same as before. It looks the same as before. It's just for purposes of health. It's nothing. Not everyone agrees with it. Most people don't agree with it. People thought there were Shlemas out, oh, he's a big maker. He's the most lenient rabbi in the world. The bum rap. I mean, to call a rabbi by a name of any sort. He saw the truth. The truth was lenient, it was lenient. The truth was strict, it was strict. Here he has a strict ruling. By the crackpots. You know? So he was looking for the truth. Okay. This Yayin Nesek business is not so simple. It's a complicated story. Yes?
Right.
The grain of the churn of the grapes is a big problem. But They weren't touching it, they were touching it with, only with their feet and not with their hands. Does that make a difference? Yes or no? So we'll see soon. Yes. No. Let me explain what I mean by grape juice not a problem. Grape juice is not a problem if you buy kosher grape juice from Keder, and then a goy will touch it with your hands after it's in your house. That is not a problem. If you buy Welch's grape juice, it's straight. Why? Welch's kosher. Oh, you? Sorry about that. What are the brand that they make? What are the goyim drink? Grape juice. Be Welch's was the I don't want to say drink. You buy, some Italian grape juice. That's a disaster because before it became grape juice, the guy already touched it. So it became trade before it became grape, before it was cooked, it was already trade. Too late. Once it's trade, it's over. That's what I only meant if you buy kosher grape juice, it's not a problem. Okay? So just to give you for openness, the Lord of Yahnez had started Kufnav Gimel. So the Ramah's first statement out of his mouth, boom. This man azeh, the Goyim don't really pour wine too often to the Goyim. So there are many who say that if a Goy touches our wine, it's not Asa Bahana, it's only Asa Mishtiyah. You can't drink it, but you may have financial benefit from it. And also Stam Yayin, their wine. You can't drink it, but you may have benefit from it. Why? Because today's Goyim are not the real Goyim anymore. Nothing else. It's just, you know, it's a folk religion. The Ramah quotes, Yesh Amrim. What's the basis for it? The basis for it is later on, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the next in the Kufkav Dalet, a Tino. What's a Tino? A baby. A Goyish baby touches the wine. He doesn't know. He never heard of Jesus or anybody else. He doesn't know from nothing. He's a little kid. There it says in the Shulchan Aruch that he only prohibits Vishtiya and not Bahana. So all Goyim today are considered like babies. They don't know, they're not really involved so much in their religion. Doesn't realize that it's wine. Someone is doing something else and accidentally touches the wine. That's not considered a regular touch. Yes, I'm sorry.
What about if it's a, let's say a cleaning lady's cleaning out a fridge or something? Is that considered
a big problem? We'll discuss the details in a moment. A big problem. Well, let's discuss it now. Shulchan Aruch had the following din. It's
if you want to look it up, your advanced name is Kuf Chav Dalet Siv Chav Dalet. Easy to remember. 124:24. Where it says that if a guy touches the wine indirectly, in other words, through something else, through a stick, or maybe through the outside of a bottle, things of this nature.
They touch the wine.
Well, hold up. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, if it's shalom the kavana, if it was without intent, then it's mutter even to drink the wine. Until now, almost all of the leniencies were very half-hearted. They just said it wasn't us about hanah. But it kept being us the b'shtir. Here, if it says two things going for you, number one, it's indirect touch. Number two, it's without kavanah to touch. So you have two things going for you, presto, it's even put the b'shtir. You can even drink the wine. Comes the Ramah and says, hey, nowadays, same Ramah rears its head. Nowadays, the goyim aren't really such devout Catholics. So all of their touching is considered what we call shalom the kavana. And therefore, if the guy doesn't touch the wine directly, he just touches it through a bottle, then perhaps it's supposed to use it to drink it. It's a bonanza. Not everyone agrees, but it is a powerful statement. The Shach tempers it as well. We only rely on this for Malkoth Hefzid. Only when you're stuck, not on a routine basis. For example, at Moshe the Tshuva, they had non-Jewish waiters pouring wine in a restaurant. So Moshe says, no way! And someone asked them, look, it's only indirect, and it's so devout. For Moshe, that's only after the fact. Post facto, Hefzid over here, get a Jewish waiter, get Yayin Mavushel. You know, almost every restaurant in the world that I know, kosher restaurant, only serves you Yayin, at least out of Eretz Yisrael, only serves you Yayin Mavushel. Because how are they going to manage it with Yayin Mavushel? It's impossible. It's impossible. They're going to do for you. You can't arrange it. So there was a time, I'm not sure what still goes on now. But these really fancy, super fancy restaurants, people want to have their super fancy wines. Which are not mavushel. Which takes the guts out, I told you before. So what do you do? So the hire only room waiters is that. No problem. So it was, they made an arrangement. They'll give you a closed bottle of the super fancy wine at your table. Okay? Closed. You're not going to sell a closed bottle of wine. And then the person himself, presumably, pour that wine. And the person himself, I mean, if the person is observant, so fine. If he's not observant, he doesn't care. So that's it. All right? That was the policy. Yes?
What about the
closed
bottle?
Right. The bottle is closed. So there's no problem whatsoever. Let me ask you a question. Who do you think are all the delivery men? The Kenem wine, every single delivery man who's picked up the case of wine that weighs 10 tons, everyone is a from you. What do you think? Maybe. But I don't think so. Pours wine out of a bottle. So the Shulchan Aruch says the double whammy. That which he poured out is no good. It's called asa b'shtiyah because the wine was moved b'koko. He didn't touch it, but it moved b'koko. And you know what else happened? That which is left in the bottle is also asa. Why? It's called nitzok. Nitzok means literally a pour it, you attack mine with full water. You tell me they... No. Connection. The water pours. What's the word to use for it?
Stream.
Stream, I guess is the best word. A stream of the wine that goes from the bottle to out of the bottle. So if the that which is out of the bottle becomes prohibited because of the co-op of the goy. And even that which is in the bottle, which never really moved, it just sort of moved around a little bit in the bottle, then went out, is also because of what we call nitzuk. Here again, the Shulchan Aruch says, Shalom the Kavana is alright. So that means that could be that the man is there nowadays, but everything the Goyim does consider Shalom the Kavana should be mutter. That's what Moshe should have about the non-Jewish waiters for the non-Jewish wines. So Moshe, you cannot rely on this lechatchila, only after the fact. It's stuck.